Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from the club's offices overlooking San Francisco's historic Market Street. I am Joe Epstein, past president of the club, and your chair for today. It is also my pleasure to welcome our radio audience joining us today for America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners to visit us on the Internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's program. Dr. Michael P. Dombeck became the 14th Chief of the U.S. Forest Service on January 6, 1997. As a young man in Wisconsin's Lake Country, he gained an appreciation for natural resources. He spent 11 summers working as a fishing guide in the region. His background also includes undergraduate and graduate degrees from the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, the University of Minnesota, and Iowa State University. He has used his education to teach biology, chemistry, science, and zoology in public schools and universities. His distinguished career of government service includes 12 years with the Forest Service and 3 years as acting director of the Bureau of Land Management. Since becoming chief of the Forest Service 3 years ago, Dombeck has focused his efforts on promoting partnerships, collaborative stewardship, accountability, and financial health. Called an out-of-the-box thinker by Forest Service insiders, Dombeck has been able to accomplish controversial goals such as the reduction of logging. In California, in 1998, logging was down 73% from the levels of the mid-1980s. In his speech today on the state of America's forests, Chief Dombeck will elaborate on his work at the Forest Service, where he must balance the needs of the present with the environment of the future. Now, in April of 1911, U.S. Forest Service Chief Henry Graves spoke to the Commonwealth Club. We were then a fledgling organization that was not even 10 years old. And here we are 90 years later. We are very pleased to welcome the Chief of the U.S. Forest Service to the Commonwealth Club of California. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Chief Michael P. Dombeck.
Well, Joe, thank you. What an honor it is for me to be speaking to a group like this, to think that my predecessor back in 1911 spoke to this group. I'd say we're well overdue to be talking about natural resources and some of the issues of the Forest Service. And to those of you that in the listening audience, I know that the issues associated with land management and the premier steward of America's public lands, the Forest Service. I'm here on behalf of 30,000 dedicated employees that work around the country for the Forest Service, natural resource managers, scientists, people running the business side of the organization, and to think of the rich heritage of this organization and to be speaking to you is just an absolute honor. As I think about the forestry and conservation and lands issues, I think what could be timelier, especially here in the West, to talk about the future of America's forests. You know, for over a century, citizens have debated the management of their forests, and the result has oftentimes been messy. It's been awkward. But the fact is, the dialogue is familiar to many of you, oftentimes resulting in litigation, resulting in new information, new science as time marches on, dealing with protests, dealing with social change, economic change, sometimes disruptions in local communities as we deal with this change. But the fact is, all of this debate that's part of democracy really does prompt the change that's needed as we apply a new management and science to the management of all the lands, not only the national forests. But what I'd like to do today is step aside from some of the contentious debate and begin a dialogue about a dialogue about some of the most basic questions. Questions like, what can we do to ensure our forests and grasslands, our river systems, retain the health, their diversity, their resilience, and productivity, so future generations enjoy the benefits that we've enjoyed? And perhaps most important is, how can we work together to ensure sustainable communities, economies that thrive, that prosper, that work in harmony to promote land health, the health that we want to bequeath to future generations? Just a few generations ago occurred one of the most significant events in the evolution of the American landscape, and that was the clearing of our forests for agriculture as a new nation was growing and developing. And the early settlers turned to America's forests for a wide variety of uses. The forests provided habitat for wildlife, a thriving and lucrative fur export market. Wood from forests warmed early settlers, provided the energy for an iron industry, powered machines. Lumber was used for our homes, our barns, our bridges, our railroad ties, even locks and dams. In fact, America's forests were, in a sense, the foundation for a developing nation and providing the commodities that were needed as the country developed. Our cities, many of our cities, were built around the values that we got from these vast lands of the United States. And if you consider, for example, Lake Tahoe, by the turn of the century, the Tahoe Basin had been clear-cut. Fuel for moving forward with the mining industry there, the timber that was needed, and a lot of changes have occurred since then. Then if you, let's start at about 1900, sort of known as the cut-and-run era by many, where timber production had demolished many forests in the Appalachians, in the Great Lakes states where I grew up in northern Wisconsin, the Northeast. And the people were tired of the fires, of the erosion that followed this management. And to protect the forests, the watersheds, President Teddy Roosevelt was really the most famous figure to be the champion conservation here in the United States. And under the direction of the first chief of the Forest Service, Gifford Pinchot, we began science-based management and the multiple-use management that we see today on many of our public lands and our national forests. And times change. World War II came another set of values, helping to fulfill a national dream, a dream of providing families with single-family homes. Good, important values at the time. And our timber harvest escalated for nearly a quarter of a century. We also encouraged many other uses of our public lands under the concepts of multiple-use management. And I want to run through a list of just a few of the benefits that you enjoy today from the 192 million acres and the 155 national forests that belong to all of the people of the United States, and in fact here in California with the 18 national forests that make up about 20 million acres of the lands of this state. For example, you can drive on 7,700 miles of scenic byways. You can boat on 4,300 miles of national wild and scenic rivers. You can hike 133,000 miles of trails, some on the 34 million acres of wilderness lands within the national forest system. You can use recreation sites, 23,000 of them, or you can camp at 43,000 individual campsites on the national forest across the country. You can use 383,000 miles of roads to access the lands that belong to you. And in fact, in 1998, we had 860 million recreation visitor days occur on the national forest in the United States, more recreation than occurs in any other entity that managing the lands here in the United States. You can apply for grazing permits. In 1998, we grazed 9.3 million animal head months on the national forests. You can benefit from the timber harvested on national forests. In fact, in 1998, we harvested 3.4 billion board feet of timber from the National Forest, and that's enough wood to build 300,000 single-family homes. The recreational opportunities are just boundless. In fact, again, in 1998, hunting and fishing on the National Forest contributed about $21 billion to the U.S. economy. You can benefit from advice and technical assistance from Forest Service managers and scientists. In fact, we provided assistance to 146,000 woodland owners on how to manage their woodlands for whatever their objectives were. Or you can benefit from the urban forestry programs. In 1998, we assisted over 9,000 urban communities in how to improve their cities through reforestation and the importance of trees adding to the beauty of the urban landscape. We produced over 2,700 technical and scientific documents. In fact, many people don't connect natural resources research with the Forest Service, but the fact is that we've got about 50% of the natural resources research capacity working for the Forest Service and many, many partnerships with the academic community. And of tremendous importance, in fact, increasing importance to all of us, is the fact that the cleanest water in the United States is flowing off of our forests. In fact, 3,400 communities obtain their water directly from national forests here in the United States, providing drinking water for about 60 million citizens, a value that we don't talk nearly enough about when we talk about forest management and all that it does for us. We know about the protection of individual species that's required. We know that we've got to protect the health and resilience of the landscapes. And really, when we talk about ecosystem management and the new concepts that have evolved over the last couple of decades, we're really talking about, a tapestry of forest life that's strong, that's securely interwoven. Part of that's high water quality, fertile, stable soils, an array of habitats for species of plants and animals. And this is complicated stuff, the function of living organisms and how they interact with the land and how they interact with one another. And that's really what forest health is all about. And there's lots of technical words, but it's really the interaction, the function, and the resilience and renewability of the landscape. And that's how we maintain the health of the forest, the health of the rangelands, generation after generation. We've heard a lot about forest health. I've had a lot of hearings associated with forest health since I've been in this job. And one might ask the question, how healthy are our forests today? And I want to say generally they're in good shape. And I want to take you back again to the turn of the century and just sort of think about where we've been and where we're going. At the turn of the century, because of the timber management practices, the lack of a science-based approach, we dealt with about 40 to 50 million acres of wildfire each year. In fact, the most serious wildfire ever in the United States was in my home state of Wisconsin in 1871. It was called the Peshtigo Fire, and it occurred the very same day that the Chicago Fire occurred. At that time, we were burning an area the size of West Virginia, Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware, 40 to 50 million acres. Today, wildfire remains a problem, but we're burning 2 to 4 million acres annually, even on some of the most severe years. At the turn of the century, we had 80 million acres, 80 million of cut-over stumplands, barrens, with eroding soils. Today, much of that land has been reforested and is in better shape, and it continues to improve. At the turn of the century, the volume of timber harvested far exceeded forest growth. Today, forest growth exceeds timber harvest and has since 1940. In fact, tree growth in 1986 was more than 3.5 times what it was in 1920. The net growth in 1997 exceeded removals by about 48%. A century ago, disastrous flooding in the east was tied to the clearing of the forest, the overcutting, the wildfires. Today, these watersheds have been reforested and are the headwaters of many American rivers, and they're now protected against overharvest. And in the West, over a third of all the fresh water in the West originates on our national forests. A century ago, America's forests were being cleared for agriculture at the rate of 13 square miles a day. Today, with increased farmland productivity, the trend has been reversed, and many of these farms, abandoned, some of them, have now been returned to productive forest lands. And a century ago, many, many wildlife species were severely depleted. They were on the brink of extinction, and we've made remarkable progress on some fronts. Think about the Rocky Mountain elk, peregrine falcons, wild turkeys now in nearly every state. Many other species of birds, including our national symbol, the bald eagle, they're recovering. But even as conditions in certain parts of the country have improved, the health of our lands and waters in other parts of the country and other places is in tough shape, and we've got our work cut out for us. For example, between 1992 in 1997, 16 million acres of forest lands, croplands, wetlands, and other open space was lost to urbanization and development. And that's a rate that has doubled just in the last decade. And due to past management practices that we didn't understand at the time, the fire suppression, our General Accounting Office reports that some 40 million acres of the national forests in the West are at risk of unnaturally occurring fires. Rivers and streams nationwide continue to be ditched, dredged, channelized, and otherwise degraded. We have a situation where we have about 35% of our freshwater fishes, 38% of the amphibians, and 56% of the mussels are imperiled or vulnerable to extinction. Due to changes in forest composition, introduced exotic insects and diseases are a big problem today. In fact, in the next 15 years, some 65 million acres of the national forest will be exposed to tree mortality that is likely to exceed the background mortality rates by 25%. In fact, of all of the natural resource challenges that we have in the United States and in the world today, the movement of species globally that had been separated by the oceans prior to the technologies that we have today is just a tremendous problem and will be big challenges for us to deal with. We've made progress, as I mentioned, with wild turkey, with bald eagles, many, many species, but yet a threatened and endangered species in general continue to grow. Today in the United States, we've got more than 1,000. The Pacific salmon, for example, are on steep decline throughout this state, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, all of the Pacific Northwest. Well, what's the Forest Service doing? How are we responding to some of these declines and so on? And let me just give you a few examples. In response to changing social values, new information, litigation, we harvest about 70% timber less from our national forest today than we did a decade ago. Clear cutting has declined by 70 to 80% as the preferred tool for timber harvest. The entire focus of the Forest Service is shifting on one that pays greater attention to what we leave on the land rather than what we take. In fact, my view is that until we start talking about the desired future condition that we want, what do we want the forest to look like? What kind of condition do we want them to be in? And then we apply the science and the management technologies to get there. Until we reach that point, the timber debates will not calm down, at least not very much. Let me mention a few of the major policies that I and we in the Forest Service have been focusing on. Our roadless initiative helps to recognize the unique role of public lands, the role that they play in maintaining large blocks of unfragmented forests that are so important as we see this tremendous development occurring all around the country. The ecological values, the social values of these areas are important for drinking water supplies, habitat for rare endangered species, species like grizzly bears and others that need that have large home ranges. They provide places for hunting, for fishing, for dispersed recreation. Roadless areas are also a bulwark against the spread of invasive and noxious weeds, introduced species. They're a barrier for that. And they're also important areas for research to provide us with a baseline of what natural communities can be like, should be like, and what their functions are. For example, 72% of the open space in L.A. County is the Angeles National Forest, where I just came from a couple of days ago. And 35% of the water delivered to the L.A. Basin comes off the Angeles National Forest. So it's easy to understand why many of these issues are so contentious and so important to so many people. Within the next week or two, we'll be releasing our draft road policy that'll help us manage the 380,000 miles of roads on the National Forest System to ensure that they're safe, to stem the landslides, the erosion, the sedimentation, and protect water quality. But having an efficient transportation system, the access that's needed to national forests, is also important when you consider that we've got 860 million visitors coming to the national forest each year. In fact, we have, on an average day, we have 1.7 million vehicles on national forest road systems, a very important part of what we do and very important to maintain our infrastructure based upon up-to-date engineering, science, and technologies. Another issue that's in play that's very important to many people is our draft planning regulations. And the objective is to ensure the protection of ecological sustainability through a framework of collaborative stewardship, of better integration of science and management. And especially important is the fact that we will operate in an even more open way to include the American public right up front in the goal-setting process, rather than the agency developing the plan and then bringing it to the public. New opportunities for people to help shape the way they want their lands, your lands, to manage and shape that right up front. And, of course, right here in California, the management plan for the National Forest of the Sierra Nevada is nearing completion. And what could be more important than the goal of restoring the function, the ecological processes in the Sierra Nevada, one of the most beautiful places in the United States and, in fact, most beautiful places in the world. I want to take a few minutes and talk about two issues that I think are of special importance here in California. Talk about them in a little more detail, water and recreation. I often refer to the National Forests as the world's largest water company, and in a little while I'll tell you why. The basic function of a watershed, of a forest, is to catch and absorb rainfall, other precipitation, store it in the soil, and gradually release it for use, function, downstream, downhill. And California, I believe, illustrates this issue probably as well or better than almost any other state, because most of the rain comes in the winter months, little in the summer, when agriculture, families, and fish and wildlife need it most. The vast majority of the rainfall in California falls in Northern California, yet the greatest demand is in the southern part of the state. So you've got both a timing problem and some problems and challenges with distribution. And the national forests, as I said earlier, comprise a fifth of the state of California, 20 million acres, and yet nearly 50% of the precipitation that falls in this state falls on national forests. In fact, nationwide, our forests make up about a third of the acreage of the lower 48, and yet about two-thirds of the runoff in the United States comes off of the forested landscapes, and the national forests are at the forefront. And the situation that we want on the land is we want the forest and the landscape to act like a sponge, to absorb that rainfall, to keep it on the land longer, to recharge the aquifers, to replenish the groundwater tables, rather than have it quickly run off and take topsoils and perhaps causing mudslides and other things that come with it. If we take a look at the economics of water, we often talk about the economics of timber, of grazing, of many other of the issues that we deal with. The marginal value of water coming off of our national forests is about $3.7 billion a year. And that's not charging the $1.29 a pint that you might at the shop down the street. That's talking about $7 to $10 an acre foot for water. And that $3.7 billion in value does not include maintaining fish species, other recreational values, the savings to municipalities. The New York City water supply is a fascinating example. There we have a watershed north of New York City, and if New York had to replace that watershed with a water filtration plant, it would cost them $7 billion just to build the filtration plant. So oftentimes those services that nature provides us, we take for granted, but yet they're exceedingly important. Then to think about the fact that 75% of the outdoor recreation in the United States occurs within a half mile of water. There's something about the soothing effect, the cooling effect. People like connecting with water, with streams. In fact, I was at a tree planting ceremony on Saturday in the San Gabriel Canyon near L.A., and we stopped along the San Gabriel River. And even on a winter, sort of a rainy day in L.A., we saw people, you know, enjoying playing in the creek. You know, it's not only the little kids that enjoy it. It's virtually everyone that enjoys the outdoors and being near water. And now, as we think about recreation, in fact, recreation is one of the four priorities that I've been focusing on since I've been in this job. And in an increasingly urbanizing country and nation, outdoor recreation is really the window through which our children connect with the land to help them learn the benefits that they derive from the land and why open space is important. The values are incredible. And many times what they bring back to their urban setting only lives perhaps in a photograph or in their memories, camping with their parents as youngsters. But the fact is, there are tremendous opportunities, whether it's seeing a crystal clear Lake Tahoe for the first time, whether it's the exhilaration of running a river in a kayak, tremendous opportunities. And then if we look at the economics of recreation and tourism, 3/4 of what the national forests contribute to the gross domestic product of the United States come from outdoor recreation. That's nearly $100 billion. Each year. And we've got a tremendously diverse portfolio of recreation opportunities here in California as well as all over the United States. And, you know, there's basically something for everyone, whether you enjoy extreme skiing, day hikes, camping, hiking, world-class fishing, backcountry experiences, motorized access, driving a scenic byway, you can find it on a national forest. And I mentioned earlier, the day is quickly approaching where we're going to see 1 billion, that's a B in billion, people visiting our national forests each year. And it shouldn't be surprising when you think about the quality of many of these resources and how thankful we need to be that future generations had the foresight and the wisdom to set these lands aside, and the many employees of the Forest Service and their partners to be stewards of these lands. For example, a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to participate in the 13th International Fly Fishing Championship, World Fly Fishing Championship. It was the first time it was held in the United States. was also the first time they caught native fish. It was held on the Bridger-Teton National Forest. And it was interesting that I was one afternoon fishing with an individual from England who was telling me that he pays £750 to fish a quarter of a mile on one side of a stream. You know, maybe we don't have it so bad after all. And we've got all of the skiing, the Continental Divide Trail, the Lewis and Clark Trail. We'll be a major partner with the U.S. ski team in the Salt Lake City in the downhill skiing event in the 2002 Olympics. National forests are part of all that. And if we come right here to California, to the 20 million acres of national forests in California, and I hope that many of you have enjoyed your national forests. I suspect you probably wouldn't be here today if you weren't somewhat familiar with them, but you've got over 8,000 miles of hiking trails, 4.5 million acres of wilderness, almost 2,000 miles of wild and scenic rivers, 49,000 miles of roads, tremendous opportunities, cross-country skiing in the immigrant wilderness area, world-class fishing in the Sierras, rafting down the Kern, hiking in the Trinity Alps. You're the owners of this tremendous resource. So we've got lots of neat things in California. The oldest organism, the bristlecone pine, the tallest tree, the redwood here in California, and the largest organism in the world, the sequoia, that starts out as a little tiny seed and grows to be one of the most majestic and magnificent resources. And the fact is that 50% of the sequoias in the world are on the national forest. Exceedingly important, worth protecting, worth safeguarding for future generations. So we've got a lot to be thankful for, but we've got a lot of challenges as we enter this new millennium. 68 million acres, as I mentioned earlier, of National Forest System lands that we predict in the next 15 years will face tree mortalities up to 25% in excess of background rates. In addition, we're close to completing fire and urban wildland interface maps that document the areas nationwide that are at risk of unnaturally occurring catastrophic wildfires that pose a threat to human safety and health. And again, no issue could be more at the forefront than that here in California. In fact, one thing I learned when I was on the Angeles just the other day is they had the last fire of the century and the first fire of the century on the Angeles here just within the past month. The ponderosa pine, one of the symbols of the West. Historically, we had low-intensity fires that cleansed the forest, cleansed the landscape, burned the dead and dying brush, the fuel, but it didn't kill the trees. Years of fire suppression, in fact, nearly a century of fire suppression, allowing fuel buildup, resulting in challenges that we have. And the fact is we've got to reapply fire to the landscape. But it's always dangerous. Fire is never something that we can be careless with. It's something that we've always got to be very cautious as we reapply one of nature's cleansing agents that was part of the very evolution of this landscape and, in fact, was used by the Native Americans to enhance wildlife habitats, to improve berry crops, and other purposes. So we've got a lot of education to do and continue to work with regard to fire. And when we eliminated fire, a couple of things happened. We lost some diversity, and we lost some of the biodiversity. And today, the remaining meadows, the openings, are disappearing from our high country. Species like Table Mountain pine and aspen are in decline because of the reduction of disturbance. The second thing that happened, the young vegetation was no longer thinned, and we ended up with overstocked stands with off-site species, again, in dry years, providing the explosive tinder that result in catastrophic stand-replacing fires that killed the big old trees, destroyed the soils that are so important. So we've got a lot of work to do. We've got some corrective action to take. We've got to restore and improve our forests. Inaction is not a solution. We've got to move forward. we've got to learn as we go. We also have to understand that these are issues that are not going to be resolved overnight. They've been developing for decades, and they will be decades in solving many of these problems over all of the acreages that we have. But we're making progress. I'm one that champions collaboration, work partnerships, and the fact is, even in some of the areas where there are very contentious issues, we've been making progress, and we've got to learn from these models of success. I recently was focusing on the work of the Flathead Common Ground Group in Kalispell, Montana. And here we had the Defenders of Wildlife, the Montana Logging Association, the National Wildlife Federation, the Intermountain Forest Industry Association, all coming together, focusing on common goals, decommissioned 116 miles of roads in that area to help grizzly bears, restored many miles of streams, burned 8,700 acres for grizzly, or rather deer and elk habitat, and harvested and treated some 633 acres in full agreement of very common objectives. Right here in California, high in the mountains of the Plumas National Forest, the headwaters of the Feather River, we're working to renew wetlands called Big Flat Meadow, increasing the intermittent flows, turning intermittent flows to perennial flows. The trout fisheries returned, and where once there were dry meadows, and now we have both open water and the wetland riparian meadow vegetation replacing the dryland vegetation, restoring habitat for waterfowl, for amphibians, for numerous mammals. And this is just one example of the many, many projects that are going on right here in California. And we need to thank the many Forest Service employees that are hard at work day after day, the many partners, the supporters of these projects. And I want to leave you with a couple of thoughts. Perhaps the most important thing we can do in restoring the health of our forest lies in the hope that as we do that, we rebuild our communities. We rebuild our relationship with the landscape. And many, if not most, of the necessary treatments won't yield commercial products, but many will. And as we seek to restore the health of the forest, we should do so in a way that we connect with local communities, we connect with the land, and we focus on the desired future condition. We need to focus on the condition we want on the land, what we want the land to be like, not what we can take from the land. If we do that, we can focus opposing points of view on a common goal and direct our resources in a positive way to making progress on the land. It's good work. It's important work. It's important socially. It's important economically. It's important ecologically. And it's worthy of our highest and best calling. Thank you, and have a wonderful 2000.
Thank you very much, Michael Dombeck, Chief of the United States Forest Service, for your presentation here today. And now, Skip Rhodes, President of the Commonwealth Club, will moderate our question and answer session. Skip.
Thank you, Joe Epstein, former club president and our chair for today. And now, Mr. Dombeck, we have a huge amount of questions for you. So if you'd step back up to the podium, we'll get at it. And while Mr. Dombeck is doing that, I'd like to recognize an environmentalist and Commonwealth Club board member who's with us today, Ambassador Bill Lane. Bill, it's wonderful to have you here. I'm going to combine two questions here. The first one is going to be dollars and cents. Why do the administrative costs of Forest Service timber planning outstrip the amount received in timber receipts? I would assume the timber companies are making a profit. And another questioner wants to know, are we subsidizing logging companies through favorable leases on federal lands?
One of the things that we see in the values associated with timber harvest is once the big trees are gone, once the old growth is gone, the values are gone. And as we deal with issues of below-cost timber sales and many of the controversies that I know some of you are familiar with, my belief, again, we shouldn't be worrying about whether it's a below-cost timber sale or not. We need to be thinking about what condition we want the land to be in, and then how do we get there. And in some cases, you're going to run a profit, and in some cases, you're not. But much of the overstocked stand issue, the fire risk issue that I talked about, the forest health issue we talked about, we really have project work that needs to be done on the land, thinning, fuel treatment, prescribed fire, and much of this will not yield a profit. And the next point that I want to make is one that I hope you all think about very seriously, is that we in the United States invest half of what we did in natural resource management in proportion to the federal budget if we compare 1962 to 1999. We need, as a nation, to do better in investing in the land that sustains us. We ran through a long period of sort of reaping the profits of centuries of timber growth, the development of the old growth, and now we've got to put some back. With regard to what was the other part of that question?
Are we subsidizing logging companies through favorable leases on federal lands?
No. What we have is we have significantly increased the commercial timber program, and that doesn't necessarily mean removals. For example, we've reduced clear cutting by 70% to 80% in the last 15 years. We have focused our project work, our timber harvest, on stewardship projects, on in excess of 80% of the timber sales that we have out there. But also, it does make sense to harvest, to utilize the timber, the fiber that's available, because we in the United States are putting a lot of our demands other places. For example, the downturn in timber as a result of the Pacific Northwest, the spotted owl issues. 10 years ago, we were harvesting over 12 billion board feet off of our national forest. Today, we're harvesting 3.5. The demand didn't decrease. In fact, demand for fiber in the United States is increasing at about 1% a year. But what has happened is that the imports from Canada have gone up from about 10 billion to about 18 billion board feet, and much of that is coming from the boreal forests of Ontario, of Quebec. And so this is a complex issue, and we need to take a look at our rates of consumption as well. We're recycling about 40% of our wood. We ought to be recycling the other 60% as well.
Do you feel the restoration program in the Los Padres National Forest following last year's fire is proving effective with recent rains and high water runoff?
I'll have to admit that I don't know the details of what's going on the Los Padres with regard to the reforestation, but I'm assuming that this is a result of fire. And the answer is yes. At the funding levels that we get from Congress, we are moving forward and reforesting as many of the areas as we have funding to do. But there's always more work than there is money. And it's funny, I know many of you run big organizations, and I doubt if you have many of your division chiefs that tell you they have more money than they need either. Every unit that we deal with always seems to need more money, whether it's recreation, fish and wildlife reforestation, all those programs.
While tremendously encouraged by the president's proposal to protect roadless areas, why are 1 million acres of ancient forests in the Northwest still open to logging? Isn't it time we ended logging in all remaining old growth and end commercial logging on public lands?
The roadless area issue, which is at this point a proposal, and as I think many of you know that have followed the issue, the scoping period was open for 60 days of public comment. What's happening now is we're developing a draft environmental impact statement, and sometimes this spring that will again go out for public comment, and that will then contain the alternatives, the range of options that we're looking at. And at that point, I invite all of you to become again involved and voice your opinion in your views on that. With regard to the issues in the Pacific Northwest, what we are doing and in a sense bound to do by the process and law is follow the direction of the Northwest Forest Plan. That was a milestone in ending the gridlock that we saw in the Pacific Northwest, but knowing that as we learn more, we need to apply the sciences, the technologies, and continue to adapt to the changes that are required as we learn more and as social opinion changes.
Why should recreational users have to pay fees in addition to state and local taxes to use public land? Isn't forest land management one of the basic purposes of government?
Yes, it is. And I mentioned earlier some of the funding problems that we see. With recreation being the fastest growth program on the national forests, our unit field managers are under tremendous pressures to deal with. For example, I know the specific data to the L.A. Basin because I just came from there, but we have 11 million people within a one-hour drive of the Angeles National Forest. We've got 22 million people within a two-hour drive. We've got 30 million visitors a year. And I was told how many tons of garbage. Brad, do you remember? Was it something like 5,500 tons of garbage that are hauled off the Angeles each year? So how do we fund this? How do we do all of this? And one of the ideas that came forward and was strongly supported by our Appropriations Committee chairman was called, in Southern California, it's called the Adventure Pass. Around the rest of the country, it's called the Recreation Fee Demonstration Pilot Project. That's basically a temporary authority for the agencies, Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service, to charge fees, providing that money is reinvested in those areas. Now, the public opinion on that has been, if you ask the question to the visitor, are you willing to pay a couple of dollars if that money comes back to the site that you visit, 80% will say yes if it comes back to that site. And I know none of us want to pay more for anything, whether it's gasoline or shoes or any other commodity or whatever that we buy. And the other thing I want to point out with the, say, for example, the Adventure Pass, which is $30 a year, that's 8 cents a day. And if you're a senior citizen, you get it at half price, that's 4 cents a day. That's less than a stick of gum. Probably not a real bad deal. But on the other hand, we need to work with the Congress, with the administration, to see that all these programs are funded at a level that, you know, we maintain the health of the land, that we maintain the quality of services, maintain the infrastructure that we have out there. Because one of the things that we're dealing with in, again, not only the Forest Service, but the other agencies, is a tremendous backlog in maintenance and reconstruction. Much of the infrastructure in our parks, our national forests, are decades old. And in the Forest Service alone, we've got $11 billion backlog in maintenance. And in the road system, we have an $8 billion backlog in maintenance. We have, for example, 7,700 bridges in the national forests. And bridges, especially wooden bridges, get older and weaker and need to be replaced. And we ought to be replacing about 400 bridges a year. Currently, we're replacing 20 to 40.
Lake Tahoe is about 3 hours away from San Francisco. Tahoe's ecological health is important to San Francisco Bay Area residents. Have you felt the political heat from our U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, who has spent a lot of effort to save Tahoe Forest as well as the lake itself?
Yes. I had the pleasure to participate in the President's Summit, as I know some of you did, a couple of years ago, that really focused on this tremendous resource of Lake Tahoe and the concern for the declining water clarity and transparency in Lake Tahoe that I understand was what not too long ago in excess of 100 feet, and now we're losing almost a foot of transparency a year. And we have significantly increased our activities in the National Forest to reduce sedimentation from roads through decommissioning, implementing various forest health projects, reducing fire risk with some of the on many of the lots in thinning and those kinds of treatments, working to reduce nutrient input, and it's very, very important work and high visibility work, and I just pleased the Forest Service as part of that. And like in all of the land rehabilitation and watershed restoration work that's needed, we just need to do more and go faster.
Next questioner asks, to what extent is the logging industry correct when it claims to be ecologically conscientious? How concerned are you about unsound practices?
Like in all organizations, I think you have many, many very good stewards, many operations on logging company lands and other lands that do an outstanding job. Many states have very good Forest Practices Acts that apply to state lands, to apply to private lands, encouraging and requiring operators to use best management practices. But as in all things, there's always room for improvement. There are always operations that you look at and say, hey, we could have done a better job. And the thing that we've got to do is promote land health, good stewardship practices. And also, public opinion has changed a lot as social values have changed over the decades. The problem of roads on national forests that I've taken head on and have some of the scars to prove it, the fact is, in the changes in technology, we have more roads than we need on the national forests, more roads that we can afford to maintain. And what we've got to do is we've got to work with the local communities to tie the transportation infrastructure of the counties, of the townships, with what's needed on the national forests, and then prioritize them, because we can't afford all that we have. And then what do we do with those that are low priority? Are they of such low value that, or from the standpoint of a transportation system, that they ought to be decommissioned, maybe turned into hiking trails, biking trails, other uses. That whole concept, and I circle back to the original question because I know that many of the large landowners as well as timber company lands are engaged in providing various services. Maine, for example, is noted for providing access and for anglers and hikers, and much of Maine is not owned by any government entity but by timber companies.
I think the last part of your answer leads into this one. What can people do to restore funding for the Forest Service so that the fee demonstration program can be eliminated? As a citizen owner of our public lands, I resent being considered a customer and a hike being a product.
Well, in fact, you are not the customer, you're the owner. And to you, just like it is to me, a hike is perhaps one of the most joyful and exhilarating experiences of the week, the month, or the year. With regard to what you can do, and let me tell you, this is what I tell employees. Money flows to things that people want. This just happens to be the way the economy of the United States operates, and it doesn't matter if you're Chevron or if you're JCPenney or Nordstrom or a federal agency. And we need to do a better job in natural resources in connecting with more people and helping them understand why investments in land are important. And that, I believe, is the key thing, because what we're about is we're about hiking and biking and hunting and fishing, preserving open space. We're about clean water. We're about some timber harvest. We're about things that society and our wealth depends upon, the very quality of life, families connecting with one another on vacations in the Sierras. That's what we're about. This is good stuff. And in the most prosperous country in the world, in perhaps the best economic times ever, it seems to me that we ought to be willing to invest in this. So the people that are in this room 100 years from now are thanking us for what we did.
What part have you personally played in the debate between the state of California, the U.S. Forest Service, and Pacific Lumber Company and its owner, Maxim Corporation of Texas?
None.
U.S. Forest Policy, U.S. Service Forest Policy has been criticized for undermanaging assets and diminishing supply. At the same time, various forecasters anticipate a global oversupply into the distant future. To what extent do you consider these global forecasts in the formulation and presentation of Forest Service policy?
Let me just say, oversupply of what I assume is the person that wrote the question in the room. Oversupply of timber. The data that I mentioned that talks about the rate of harvest versus the rate of growth, we're gathering more up-to-date information on that. And I think you will continue to see the balances change. And much of the harvest levels from national forest lands are being dictated by litigation, by social values, by other things. And my view is one of the most important things we can do is focus on education to help people understand why healthy forests, why good management is important. In addition to that, then capitalize on and make investments in research and developing markets for many of the species that need to be removed, for example, in the Quincy Library effort, so we can get some economic benefits from those species and achieve that balance. Of all of the issues that I deal with in this job, and some days you're just searching for an area of agreement because it seems like there aren't any, this whole area of forest inventory and analysis, the assessment, the survey work, is an area where I see virtually everyone in agreement. Because when we really have a good picture of what the distribution, the health of our forests are across all ownerships, then we can better understand the impacts of reductions in one area and the impacts on the other area. For example, in the southeast now, we're harvesting our softwood faster than it's being replaced. And in other areas, the opposite is true. So the inventory and analysis, and we have ratcheted up the inventory cycle from every, was it 10 to 15 years, to now, I believe, every 5 years, and with the remote sensing technologies that we have, our ability to do it cheaper and better has improved significantly.
Ronald Reagan, when governor of California, was quoted as saying, "If you've seen one tree, you've seen them all." With today's urban growth, does that quote also represent any kind of significant opinion among Americans?
I guess everyone is entitled to their opinion. This is happens to be the way the United States operates. But urban forests, I can't emphasize enough how important urban forestry is. We have 60 million acres of urban forests in the United States. And for example, if we take the city of Atlanta, if we increase our canopy cover in Atlanta, and you could do that by planting three trees around a single-family home, and if you select the right species and put them in the right location, you can cut your air conditioning costs by 20%. And even in cities in the north, like Milwaukee, you can increase your energy costs. You can decrease your energy costs, and you can decrease your stormwater runoff treatment costs by having a good canopy cover, the highest density of trees that the landscape will allow. And in fact, I participated along with Regional Forester Brad Powell, who's here, with a ceremony with the tree people in L.A. where they actually removed the asphalt from a large area of a parking lot at a school, planted trees, planted grass to slow down the water, to beautify the landscape of the school, and are installing, in fact, an 800,000-gallon cistern that will collect the water in the winter, and that will provide the water needs for that school for half of the year instead of just letting the water rush off to the Pacific and then worry about where in the wet season and then worry about where we're going to get the water in the dry season. And we can't do enough of that. In fact, when people say to me, Chief, what are the two or three major problems you see in natural resources and forest management in the United States today? I would say we've got the forest health issues that I talked about that include fire risk, pest management, and so on. We have the invasive exotic species that are coming in at an unprecedented rate that have resulted in things like the loss of our elms through Dutch elms disease, the chestnut blight, the white pine blister rust, introduced star thistle and leafy spurge and species after species into the United States. But then the other issue we've got to make some investments on is education. You know, with 80% of the American public living in urban areas, in cities and towns, we have to make sure people remain connected to the land, that they understand why the function of the land is important. And that's one of the reasons I spend a lot of time talking about water. Because if we're going to have an issue in this century in the United States, it's going to be that one. And the fact is the cleanest water in the United States right now is flowing off of our forests, and we've got to keep it that way.
Unfortunately, Chief Dombach, we've come to that time in our program when we have time for one last question. And as the Chief and I were talking just before the start of this program, I asked him if there were any questions that might be off the table. And he said, no, not any. I answer anything that comes before Congress and when I'm there testifying. And so here might be a question that may be a first. I don't know if Congress has asked you this, but this questioner wants to know, are you ever afraid to be alone in the woods?
No. And at the risk of getting in trouble, I think I grew up on a national forest. In fact, I think I'm the only chief that actually grew up on a national forest 25 miles from a town of 1,500 in northern Wisconsin. And now I live in the D.C. suburban area. Never, ever thought I'd want to live in a big city. And I was talking to one of my neighbors one day, and he was getting ready to go camping. And he was going to take his gun along. And I said to him, I said, you know, you need that gun here a lot more than you do in the woods. Perhaps being in the woods will be the safest place you'll be this whole year. And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Our thanks to Michael Dombach, Chief of the United States Forest Service, for joining us today. We also thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club, as well as those listening on the radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest continuous public affairs forum, is adjourned.